the president asked, quite obviously, even though he knows what he's seeing, what is your job here at NASA? And the janitor, without skipping a beat, says, my job, Mr. President, is to put a man on the moon. It's the number one thing he remembered from the trip. He's like, look, if the janitor knows what the job is, we're getting to the moon first. And I think that's, you know, kind of one of those things where if you can do the tactical well, if you can do your actual job well, but still keep the strategic in mind, you know, the big vision, the big direction you want to go, those teams can take pretty heavy hits and still power forward. And so I think that's where it becomes a little more art than science. It becomes, hey, how do we create a resilient, motivated culture that can knock sideways, fall apart, get hit and knocked down, and pick themselves up and get ready to ride again.
Welcome to the Beyond Speaking podcast from Premier Speakers Bureau, featuring in-depth conversations with the world's most in-demand keynote speakers.
I'm with Rourke Denver. So Rourke has an amazing story. We're going to get a whole lot of it, but if you've seen the movie Act of Valor, so he was the commander of SEALs in that. He's been deployed all over the world, in Africa, Middle East, South America, and all these hot spots around the world, and is an expert on leadership, on culture, on teamwork, and so we're going to get into a lot of that today. So Rourke, thank you so much for coming
on
and being part of this.
Yeah, I'm excited to spend time.
Yeah, so I'm curious to know, like, did you just wake up one day and say, I'm just going to be in the number one movie in America
no,
in 2012?
No. That, I mean, look, this is longer down the bio than usually I start with, but, you know, I was kind of late in my military career. I was running training for the SEAL teams, and then they asked us to do this movie. We thought this was going to be the bottom of a Walmart DVD recruiting film. Nothing would ever come of it. Next thing you know, at the Super Bowl, the ads start running, and my cell phone's just dropping with all my buddies being like, are you in a movie right now? I was like, I am, but it's kind of got away from us. So no, never did I think that was, one, going to happen. Two, it would do well. And three, I would do it while on active duty in the military.
Yeah, so I mean, like, it's fun. Like, I watched it when it came out, and right now it's on Amazon Prime. I'm sure it'll move around different times. So how much of that movie, like, I watched today at lunch, I watched that sequence, that opening sequence of, like, where you're rescuing the woman. How much of that, I mean, I know names and locations have changed, but how much of that is real?
It's very real, but in kind of a circuitous route. So the reason we called it Act of Valor is that all the individual acts, like at one point, spoiler alert, but at one point in the movie, you know, somebody gets shot 27 times and lives. Another person gets shot through the eye, goes out, you know, another part of their head, they walk to the helicopter and make it out of there. Somebody gets hit with an RPG and it doesn't go off, and then a teammate of mine jumped on a grenade to save a bunch of our teammates on the battlefield in 2006. So we tried to inject a bunch of our real history, individual events, into the storyline. The geopolitical threat scenario of bad guys coming from all over the world was made up, so to speak, but not implausible, of course. So it was a little bit of both. It was a little bit of real things from our history, and then also a threat scenario that you could build a film around.
Yeah.
And we were very cognizant to try and make it authentic and as real as we could make it without giving a playbook to our enemies. So we were kind of trying to do both the whole time.
Yeah. I mean, it's just fascinating. Like, you're just watching, like, what do you do with your parachute and your helmet after you jump in? Do you hide that stuff?
Or it depends. It depends on the missions. I mean, if you hit the water, it's going to the bottom of Davy Jones' locker, as we say, it's going to sink. If you can, there's some gear we will jump into a target where it's, you're going to try and keep it, put it aside, and hopefully get it on the way out.
Yeah.
And there's some gear that's just going to become a casualty of the game, and it's not going to get reused, not by us.
Yeah. So how how did you get into? So I know you're an All-American at Syracuse in lacrosse. You know, this big dude. After playing, you can tell I'm sitting up tall, right? he's a little bigger than I am, but you know, 6'2", 2'4". You're like Mike Trout dimensions.
Yeah.
So anyway, what made you decide to become a SEAL?
Yeah. So I did not have that lifelong calling. I mean, military service in the United States, I write about this in my second book, really has become a family business. I mean, the number of people that have multi generations within their family that have served is absolutely off the charts. And I had that. I had uncles that served. My dad's dad, my grandfather, was killed in the Pacific Theater of World War II. So there's a lot of military history. I just had not had a focus on doing that would be a path for me, which in hindsight, I'm surprised I didn't kind of come to it sooner. But I'm a senior in college in upstate New York. I'm a fine arts major, so I have no idea and basically no potential to probably put food on the plate when I leave. And my dad sent me a paperback copy of Winston Churchill's My Early Life. So it's an autobiography that he wrote much later in life. Churchill did. And something about that book was like a lightning bolt to service. It really was a call. I figured if I wanted to kind of, be part of this society, earn my seat and be at the table, that military service in particular as a leader would be the right place to go. So then I walked into a recruiter's office in upstate New York and said, I want to be a SEAL. After the laughter died down because nobody makes it, they said, well, let's do it. I said, draw the paperwork up. And somehow I snuck myself into that place and it ended up being in, 20 of the greatest years of my life, for sure.
Yeah, and of course, when you came in, it wasn't, this is before 9/11.
Pre-9/11.
So, yeah, it was like a few years beforehand. Yep. I mean, how do you train not knowing what's going to happen?
That's a great question. I mean, I think the nice thing is you still had legacy guys that had had Vietnam experience, or at least the trainers that had trained the guys that were training us that were all Vietnam combat experience guys that had been in Panama and Grenada and some of the other small incursions we'd had. I think you just know as a warrior, particularly in the professional discipline, that the only thing you can do is keep your sword sharp, keep your powder dry, and be ready to go. And that means training with the purpose of knowing that if it happens, you're ready. Mm-hmm. The last thing you want to do is ask for training or ask for ability. There's that great quote that's, you'd rather be a warrior in a garden than a gardener in a war. So
yeah.
You have to be prepped and focused in a way that you're ready to go do the job when the call comes. Mm-hmm. We didn't realize it was going to come that quickly and intensely in my career. So I got very lucky. I got to deploy several times pre-9/11, and then I got about a baker's dozen of years chasing bad guys.
Yeah. So one of the things, too, you talk about that when you go and talk to corporate events or corporate clients is culture. And you said that when you start Navy SEALs, culture starts day one.
Day one.
How do you start that?
Well, the best thing about being a SEAL is SEALs train SEALs. So the only people that run our basic training compound are guys that are coming from the battlefield. Now, in my era, it was fantastic. When I went through training, most of those instructors were phenomenal guys, well-trained and prepared. They hadn't seen the battlefield. When I got in charge of training and my instructors were teaching lessons to the young guys, you're like, you guys better pay attention because there's 3 Silver Stars, Purple Heart, 2 Bronze Stars. I mean, unbelievable amount of combat experience of those guys passing that on. We do it in simple building blocks. I mean, I think like SEAL training is exceptionally hard. It is not complex, at least in the beginning. It's sand, cold water, and concrete. We just make it very hard on you physically and mentally and push you, and you're cold, wet, and shivering, miserable for days on end. And for most people, they don't have the commitment to see it through. Amidst that, we're teaching lessons constantly. We're team over self. It pays to be a winner. The only easy day was yesterday. Be someone special. These are monikers that live within our training compound that, again, are very simple. But if you think about that, be someone special. If you are, that's a pretty good thing to have in an organization. So it's driven from the day you show up until the day you leave that job.
Uh-huh. What part? Now, I know you've got girls and kids. What part of SEAL training do you pass on to them? Like, this is the culture that you have. Obviously, their kids are not doing the same thing. But there are certain lessons that you had that fit within that.
I'd say if you could, I'd take 3 things away. There's probably only one that really counts. We'll start with the other 2. Training and mindset, without question, is something I want to pass my girls. Let's say you're in competition. I have a daughter that's a volleyball player. I'm like, you have 2 responsibilities in getting good at that game and doing it well. One is to train. It is to put in the time and the reps of serving, bumping, passing, setting, all the different technical things you have to do to be good at volleyball. So that's part 1. Training is critical. And frankly, you can have a great mindset if you don't train at all. Like, I'm not going to jump in a ring with John Jones in the UFC and my mindset might be tougher and not have him whoop up on me. Like, I'm pulling a weapon and that's how I'm getting out of that fight. So you can't supersede training with just mindset. But if you train hard, then I've found the teams that perform at the highest level are the ones with a tremendous mindset and focus and discipline and culture that kind of leads towards successes on the battlefield, so to speak. The third, which I'd say if there's anything you could take away from the program, is just to never quit. It's just never quit. When a young line used to, even currently, will ask me for mentorship to head into the SEAL teams, I used to send like a 3-page document that would say, read this book. Here's some quotes from the Spartans and, the samurai code and the chivalric code and all these things you should know. And now it's basically I could do the whole email in a subject line. It's don't quit.
Don't quit.
I mean, you don't quit, you're probably going to be a SEAL. If you quit, you're definitely not.
Yeah.
And it's simple but potent.
When did you realize, I'm a SEAL?
I think it's a slow burn in some ways. You know, you finish SEAL training. In my area, you actually finish SEAL training, graduate in San Diego. You go to advanced training either on the West Coast or the East Coast. I went to the East Coast. In that era, you actually were at a team for 6 to 8 months without what's called your trident, without the SEAL insignia pin that you earn once you are full-fledged, you know, born into that community as a SEAL. So it was every bit a year, you know, after training before I could actually say I was a SEAL.
Mm-hmm.
I'd say the first time I deployed, my team was in charge of Central and South America, running counter-drug, counter-narcotic operations in Colombia and Ecuador and all over Central and South America. I'd say the first time I deployed, I was down a country with, you know, concealed weapons, liaising with, you know, the military group leaders and dignitaries down there and kind of running nothing like the missions that were to come, but sort of in harm's way. I was like, I think I'm doing this job for real. And yeah. Then the first time I hit Iraq and Afghanistan, it was definitely, well, we're frogmen now.
What was the hardest? I know you can't give all the details, but which was there like one particular mission that was the hardest or the most difficult?
You know, I don't really have one that I'd say, hey, this is the most difficult. I mean, I think anytime you lose a teammate, obviously that's going to ring out in your mind. We lost several teammates at our entire team in my summer of 2006 deployment. Fortunately, none of them were in my tactical element. That had nothing to do with the leadership, exceptional leadership across all those different elements. I would say as a leader, when one of your guys is hurt or your guys are in harm's way and there's not something you could do about it, that is a helpless situation. That's a helpless feeling. I remember my guys going on a mission. I got pulled into a different brief that I had to go brief some senior leadership within the country. And I came back to what's called our TOC, our Tactical Operations Center. And one of my young officers, some of our guys were in a pretty horrific gunfight. A grenade had come over, it injured a couple of my guys. We hopped in vehicles very quickly, driving out there to be what's called a quick reaction force, basically go in and rescue them. And when they came up over this hillside, they'd already won the fight, but I mean, you know, it's gruesome, but guys, you know, bloody and battered. That was an intense feeling to know that my troops were in harm's way without me there, not like they ever needed me, frankly, to lead them. I mean, the best thing about being an officer in charge of SEALs is I never had to crack the whip. I was almost always pulling the reins back because our guys are such problem solvers and so intense that they don't need a lot of direction. Sometimes they need a little bit of guidance and maybe just the choke collar thrown on so they don't take it totally off the tracks, but... those are the missions I remember where something went wrong and I wasn't in a position to affect the change. You know, it's I think athletes are the same, right? Like the champions, they want the ball when the game's on the line. And I was that way in sports, and that's why I wanted to be an officer. I wanted to be in charge. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to lead.
Yeah. And that's one of those things, like as a leader, you want your people to be independent of you to a big extent. You know, we work with a lot of leaders, you know, you speak to a lot of leaders all the time.
Yeah.
What are the ways that you can help your people become more independent?
Yeah, I mean, I think it goes back to training, right? So anybody, whatever discipline, whatever business you're in, whatever organization you're a part of, I don't think you can ask or, you know, even reprimand or give somebody a hard time if they're not meeting what you expect, if they don't know what the expectations are. So I think one of the things we do in the military that's absolutely across the board is your expectations are known for almost everything we do. Look, this is what we expect for you in this training exercise. This is what we expect you for how much you're going to weigh, what you do with, you know, your shave in the morning, what time you're wearing this uniform, and so on and so forth. All these things are very, very lined out and have a tradition for purpose of them working for you on the battlefield. And so I think we're very good at setting out expectations. So I think leaders, there's oftentimes that I see leaders that are very capable, very competent, and then expect greatness from their people, but have not told them how to get there. Hey, these are the steps you need to take to achieve what I'm looking for. Mm-hmm. This is what I want the results to be. So those are huge components. The thing I like the most is I don't like micromanagement when it comes to a leader. I think if you're worth your salt as a leader, you build a team and surround yourself with exceptional people and people that can do the job. You give them the goal or the end state and let them run. Mm-hmm. And then you adjust, right? That's what I'm saying. I only ever kind of steered my team. I never cracked the whip or was the engine for it. So I think leaders that have figured out, get the right people, train them up properly, give them the expectation, then give them the resources to meet that expectation, those teams can't be stopped.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How do you deal with, you know, bouncing back from difficult things? Obviously, we've had COVID. A lot of companies are bouncing back from difficult situations. And, you know, you're talking about 2006, so many different things.
Yeah.
As a leader, how do you help your teams come back from difficult places?
I think it's just keeping that compass bearing of what the goal is. You know, there's one of the impetus for the start of the SEAL teams was actually JFK, of all people. JFK, when he, you know, kind of came into office, wanted this counterterrorism coming from the sea type military unit. He sort of called for what would become the SEAL teams. There's a story I share with companies, and I can make it quicker than I'd share in the full length, but JFK also, when he was elected, told the world that we were going to put a man on the moon. Well, look, he had the job, but he hadn't visited NASA. So he literally had not, like, talked to the astronauts or the people that are going to try and do it. So he visits NASA. And you can look this story up. He gets down to NASA. Of course, he gets in this briefing room with, like, the smartest people on planet Earth, right? Mathematicians, astrophysicists, literally rocket scientists, engineers, smartest people he's ever been in a room with, most likely. They explain the math. This is how we're going to do it. At the end of that meeting, they say, we also need to take you, Mr. President, out to the training ground where we're going to teach these astronauts how to do this and physically prepare them for the rigors of this mission set. As JFK describes it, he walks out of that briefing room. There's a long, you kind of marble polished floor leading out to where they're going to leave the building, 100-yard long, some odd floor. And as he describes it, it's the most beautifully polished floor he's ever seen. Nicer than the White House, absolutely spectacular. Three-quarters of the way down the hall, as he's walking with all the engineers and the heads of NASA, there's a janitor that's mopping the floor. And I bet NASA's like, how on earth did we leave the janitor in the hallway? The president's here. This is a total snafu. Well, it's a president, so of course he's going to stop and talk. So as he describes it, he says, hey, you know, how you doing today? Great, Mr. President, how are you? And to keep it quick, the president asked, quite obviously, even though he knows what he's seeing, what is your job here at NASA? And the janitor, without skipping a beat, says, my job, Mr. President, is to put a man on the moon. So the number one thing he remembered from the trip. He's like, look, if the janitor knows what the job is, we're getting to the moon first. And I think that's, you know, kind of one of those things where if you can do the tactical well, if you can do your actual job well, but still keep the strategic in mind, you know, the big vision, the big direction you want to go, those teams can take pretty heavy hits and still power forward. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's where it becomes a little more art than science. It becomes, hey, how do we create a resilient, motivated culture that can knock sideways, fall apart, get hit and knocked down, and pick themselves up and get ready to ride again? And great leaders, you know, do that for their teams.
Yeah, and I think one of the things too that I like that you talk about is like SEAL selling. Like, you have to be able to, you know, selling is not just trying to get people to buy things.
Yeah.
It's to, you know, kind of buy into the mission.
100%.
Like, how do you? What are the tactics you use to do that? Because obviously you're having data that's changing all the time.
Yes.
You're going to new situations.
Yes.
So many surprises. How do you sell that?
Yeah, it's funny. I did a big sales conference, and I remember when I did the pre-calls, you know, you do a lot of calls with a company in advance of the call. I could tell there were skeptics. They're like, why are we going to have this Navy SEAL talking to us about selling? And I said, I appreciate it. I get what you're saying. However, what you might not realize is that one of my primary jobs as an officer was to brief senior leadership against sister organizations. There might be a Marine tactical element, an Army unit in theater, and then us, and all of us might be briefing up to a senior general or admiral that's going to give you the green light to go or no go. And the job of the officer is to go in there and pitch that mission, pitch their capabilities, what we think the results will be, how we're going to achieve that mission set, and then convince them to say, we pick you. And so I feel like I figured out pretty quick, through some good mentorship as well, but also just kind of on my own watching the way people would brief, that really what I was selling was me and us. I was selling our team, not what the mission result would be or any technology we had that we could leverage compared to somebody else in the battlefield. And so I like to tell stories and I like to brief, so I'm comfortable talking. But I would see occasionally, you know, a young officer, I'm not even going to say the sister, you know, but a young officer get up there and brief a mission and kind of just be like a robot. You know, he's like, sir, we're going to take 250 men and we will be attacking the target from the south. And, you know, just go through this very rote explanation. I mean, all the I's dotted, all the T's crossed, but that's how he briefed the mission. And then I'd go in next and be like, hey, sir, I could give you all the X's and O's of this mission, tell you exactly how we're going to skin this cat, and I'll get into some of those details so you feel comfortable with what we're doing. I want to tell you about my team. Hey, this is my lead sniper. Grew up here. Can shoot the eye out of a bird flying, one of the most capable people you ever see on the battlefield. My two lead navigators could navigate in, you know, underneath a sewer in Calcutta and find their way to the target absolutely on a premium level. And I'd just start going into who we were, and I'd sell us. And I felt like more often than not, the commander would be like, I want him in charge, and I want them to go. Mm-hmm. And it had far less to do with capacity and more with who we were and just belief in I'm sending somebody there that I have confidence in. So I think that's where the selling goes. And, you know, I've talked to sales organizations, and, you know, half the people that do sales for a living don't even know you're supposed to ask for the sale.
Yeah.
That'd be something good to know if you're in sales. And so I'd be like, look, we want to do this mission. We're going to win this mission. We're not going to embarrass you on the battlefield. I guarantee it. And they'd be like, yeah, go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You talked about just now about having some great mentors. Mm. I know one of them I was reading about is that you a lesson that you learned from one of the top snipers on top of a mountain in Afghanistan. Yeah, what's that story?
Yeah, and that's, it's almost, do I share that?
Because I like Okay, no, well, you don't have to.
I will.
We don't want to rip.
No, no.
Actually, book Rourke Denver.
Yeah,
there we go.
That was what was.
Or another mentor.
And it's why I had so much fun. You know, it's why I have so much fun doing this speaking, because almost all the lessons I share come from the battlefield, an intense sports game, running training, and really seeing these things unfold in real time, often in very, very intense situations. The mountaintop one is a great one, and we won't be ruining anything with it. We had spent time up in this mountain, Afghanistan, basically observing or doing reconnaissance over this entire valley. We're trying to figure out where the Taliban was coming in to set roadside bombs on American and conventional forces moving through there. And I'm looking through, I'm sitting next to one of my lead snipers. I mean, I was in his wedding, he was in my wedding. He's one of my favorite people of all time. We're looking through the same power binoculars, and every 15, 20 minutes, he's seeing something on this hillside that I'm not seeing. And after like the fifth of them, I'm like seriously annoyed writing it down, you know? And then we finish the mission, we basically get back to our training room where our staging room where we have all our gear. Everybody's gone home or gone to bed. I've written up the after action report. I go in to clean my gear. He's meticulous on how he's a sniper, so meticulous on how he cleans his optics and all his gear. And he can tell that I'm not in a good mood, like, you know, which is exciting for like the boys. Of course, they're going to be super excited when the LT's upset. But he's like, what's going on with you? I was like, I don't understand. I don't understand. We're both trained the same. We have the same power binoculars. You're seeing everything on this hillside, and I'm not seeing any of it. And he very calmly says, are you looking at the whole hillside? I said, of course. He said, that's your problem. It's too much information to digest. You've got to break it down into smaller components. I use a grid square. Some guys use circles, but you break it down into a smaller piece of information. You really burn into that. You look into that spot, and things will start popping for you. And as he walks out of the room, he says, boss, if you look at less, you'll see more. Drops the mic, walks out of the room. Very annoying, very annoying. But an amazing lesson. And one of the things I love from my time and the lessons that I try and share with audiences, there's almost always a tangible tactical lesson. Like at that point, I never looked through binoculars again without breaking up the information into smaller pieces. It proved to be a better leadership lesson. And every CEO that's going to listen to this podcast or leader is going to know what I mean. We always have too much on our plate. You always have too much that you're going to try and get done mm-hmm. in a single day. And what you find is if you try and get all of it done, you get none of it done. Mm-hmm. But if you can focus in on one thing, if you can, look, this is an immediate fire that one I can achieve success on. I have the resources to action and we can get done today. If you do that, you'll sort of get to the end of your week and be like, I got about triple done than what I would have if I tried to get it all done.
Yeah.
And so it just became a real gift that it was a tactical lesson that proved to be a better leadership lesson. Look at less, you'll see more.
I know one of the other great things you like to talk about are boots on the ground. Like, how do you start your day for success?
Yeah, I mean, I think everybody's got, how they kind of rev up for the day. But I think far fewer people are very disciplined about the way they do that. One of my great mentors, unbelievable businessman, husband, father, very, very strong man of faith. He's, I think, in his late 70s now and still just an absolute beast. He gets up every day, and I've done a little bit of a manipulation of what he does, but basically get up and put 30 minutes into kind of prepping for the day. 10 minutes of, I would say, he would say prayer. I'm for that. If you're not a prayer, do 10 minutes of breathing. 10 minutes of just kind of get yourself focused, centered, and ready for the day. So 10 minutes of that. just 10 minutes of reading, which I love. So whatever you want to read, you could read the Daily Stoic. You could read, read the Bible, read whatever, read comic book. It doesn't matter. Read something for 10 minutes, and then he writes for 10 minutes. Mm-hmm. So he writes down either intentions for the day, something he wants to get off to a friend. It could be a letter. But he does those three things to start his day. And I've adopted that, and it's had tectonic shifts in how my day kind of gets going. Mm-hmm. It's just starting with purpose and kind of a discipline. The thing I miss the most about the military is just, it sounds like the regiment instead of the discipline would be annoying. It was like the most freeing thing ever because you didn't have to worry about anything. Like, this is what time I show up. This is what time I shave. Not anymore. This is what time I put my uniform on. This time when we work out. It was all very structured. And I actually miss that structure. So I think you don't have to do those three things. You don't have to do three things. Maybe you just do one thing in the morning. But I think if you did one thing very consistently, we know consistency creates actual results. You know, there's people that are like, well, I want to lose weight. Well, they stop eating terribly for a week. And then a week later, they go back to it. Nothing's going to happen. But if you're like, hey, eat half better, not even the full Monty, for 6 months, you're going to have unbelievable results.
Yeah.
So I think starting with that consistent discipline a day is a super smart thing to do.
Yeah. Awesome. Yeah. So who is the best teammate that you've ever had, ever worked with?
Oh, man. I mean, look, I've had a spectacular gift to be around the people I got to spend time with. The talent level, the hilarity of the guys, the intensity of the guys, the challenge of the guys, those are really what the job was all about. I mean, I don't look back on the mission sets and, you know, jumping out of planes was great, blowing things up was great, shooting over a mile was great. I remember the troops and the teams and the relationships. I would say picking any one is borderline impossible. I will say I got a very special gift early in my career, and it was this. The very first commanding officer, okay, and the second commanding officer. So the commanding officer in a military unit is basically the CEO, right? The top person in command. But my first two senior officers were equally the best officer I ever worked for and the worst officer I ever worked for in 20 years. And you want to talk about an unbelievable gift. It was sort of veiled at the time, but to start your career as a young officer and have an absolute archetype, prototype of what you want to be, and then the opposite of what you don't want to be, is like the gift of gifts. Yeah. So I always tell people when they're, look, all of us are going to deal with a rough boss. It happens. And, you know, I say, if you're the boss, make sure you're not that person, right? Now, that doesn't mean you need to be friends and easy. You can still be disciplined and have tremendous expectations and hold people accountable. But I learned great things from both. And I think I learned equal, in some ways, if not more, lessons from the bad leader. Because mm-hmm. I'm like, that's not who I want to be.
Yeah.
I definitely want to be this leader. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the components of what made those leaders were super simple. One was authentic, the other was not. One was disciplined, the other wasn't. One lifted you up and served you, the other one believed you worked for him. Mm-hmm. You know, one was a motivator, the other one just sucked the air out of the room and made you felt terrible no matter what was happening. One had tremendous intellectual horsepower, the other one I think was intellectually fragile. I mean, it was just all these things that you just like, oh my goodness, it's like a Dick and Jane book on how to lead and how not to lead.
Yeah.
But I'd say in many ways, those two end up being two of my greatest teammates mm-hmm. because they offered me equal gold in who I wanted to be and who I didn't want to be.
Yeah. Now, I will admit, that was part of a trick question.
Yeah.
So I was going to get that. So what? Tell me about your bride.
She's been
a great partner.
Well, yeah.
Because you talk about her and I work with her a bit. So.
No. In life, yeah, I got so myopically focused on SEAL teams. No, look, I hit the lottery in my bride. And the fact that she has stuck with me. We met within a year and a half of my career starting in the SEAL teams. So pre-9/11, we were together, and she stuck with me through the entire thing to a 20-year finish line, multiple deployments, multiple times, you know, kissing me goodbye, closing that door, not knowing if she's going to see me again. Every time I leave, that's when the pipes burst. That's when something goes wrong at home. The finances collapse. You know, some calamity unfolds. She is the top teammate. You're not kidding. Just smart, challenging, holds me accountable, has made me better at every turn in every part of who I am. Yeah. I used to tell the young lions that are going through SEAL training, I said, you know, life is really about choices. It is about choices. The choices you make are going to direct, whether it be in friends, decisions on paths you're going to take, and how you're going to choose even your daily life. That is going to lead towards, you know, greatness, excellence, or disaster. Choices are what are going to lead to that. And I remember I used to tell them, I'd say, and I usually give this speech right before Hell Week, which is sort of the last, like, you get through Hell Week, you're probably going to be SEAL. Unless you're terrible underwater or you do something really dumb with a gun or explosives, you're probably going to make it. So right before Hell Week, I used to tell them, I'd say, hey, this is most of the choices you're going to make in this life. Like, are we getting chicken or steak? That's not a big choice. Do we go right or left on this street? Maybe that leads to calamity or greatness. But in general, most of the choices you're going to make are not going to have a huge impact. There are a few choices that are going to change the absolute trajectory of your life. And this week will be one of those. If you decide to stay, you make that choice, you're probably going to be a frogman. Mm-hmm. You decide to quit, you're not. You're moving on to do something else. So make that choice wisely. Mm-hmm. And then they'd get through the week. Maybe a month later, when they'd gotten through all the things, they're definitely going to be SEALs. They'll be like, hey, I told you about those choices. That was a big one. And you, all that are still here in the room, made the right choice. The next one, if you haven't done it already, is who you choose to marry. Mm-hmm. Don't screw that up. Make that choice well, because that will absolutely impact, you know, your glide slope or path for the rest of your life. And I chose very wisely.
That's awesome. Yeah. That's awesome. Yeah. Well, so last question here. Please. You know, leaders are readers. You're a huge reader. Yeah. You say your dad is one of the biggest readers that you've ever been around. What are you reading right now? Or maybe if you were to talk to somebody like, hey, these are two or three books that are the best for helping you choose that next path.
Boy, oh boy. I mean, it's like, you know the deal. You like to read too, obviously. It's like impossible to pull these lists. But I talk about this enough. There's a few books that have impacted me recently that I really I really have high regard for. The Daily Stoic is, you know, we talk about that morning routine. Sometimes if I have nothing else to read, that's at least going to be part of it. If you don't know that book, you know, Holiday wrote this book that takes all the Stoic philosophy and kind of distills it down. And he's written it in this 365-day cycle. Mm-hmm. So you pick up the day of the month, you read that page, and it's like a paragraph just on how to think about your day and think about the world. So Daily Stoic, off the charts. My dad rode crew in college. There's a book that I can't believe hasn't become a movie yet. I think it will be, but called The Boys in the Boat. If you haven't read The Boys in the Boat, mind-blowing. This kid's path and then the road in the Olympics when Germany hosted, when Hitler was still in power. That's obviously a very powerful backdrop for that. So those two are fantastic. And then, you know, Churchill has kind of been one of my sort of ghostly mentors. As I mentioned, My Early Life is a book that just really carried me a long way and set me on a new path in my journey. I'd say, you know, biographies or autobiographies of great people or people you admire, mm-hmm. I'd grab those because I love reading about people. I love reading about deeds done and how it went. And, you know, usually by the time they write that or it gets written about them, the tale's been told. And then you get to kind of see where it goes. But those would be a couple I'd recommend highly.
Yeah, great. Yeah. Well, Rourke, thank you so much for coming on and being a part of this. For those of you who are watching or listening, make sure to go to premierspeakers.com and look up Rourke Denver there. And for those watching, listening as well, make sure to subscribe, rate, and review. So Rourke, thank you so much for coming on and being part of the podcast.
I appreciate it. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yep.
Thank you for joining us for the Beyond Speaking podcast. To learn more about today's guest, visit premierspeakers.com. Make sure to subscribe and leave a review wherever you listen.